John Krakauer's beat is the world's most inaccessible places and the men and women who journey there. Krakauer writes about mountaineering and rock climbing. And on this edition of Fresh Air, John Krakauer joins us with tales of adventure, fear, and embarrassment. Also today, we talk with sculptor Dwayne Hansen, creator of statues so real, they're sometimes mistaken for the real thing. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Gunther Schuller's attempt to finish Charles Mingus's extended work, Epitaph. And we remember master designer and woodworker George Nakashima, who died over the weekend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court today limited the use of videotaped evidence against drunk drivers, but said some portions can be used. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Inocencio Muñez was arrested on a Pennsylvania highway after failing a field sobriety test. At the county booking center, he was routinely videotaped. First, he was asked the usual booking questions, name, age, address. He stumbled in some of his responses. Then he was asked, when you turned 6 years old, what was the date? Muñez replied, I don't know. He was then asked to repeat the sobriety test he'd taken in the field, and in the process he volunteered some incriminating statements. Only later was he advised of his right not to talk and to have a lawyer. Today the Supreme Court ordered the state courts to reconsider his conviction because the court said one portion of the tape used against Muñez had violated his constitutional right not to incriminate himself. By a 5-4 vote, the court said the question put to Muñez about the date he turned 6 had compelled the defendant to give testimony against himself. The rest of the tape, the court said, could be used because the statements were either routine booking questions or volunteered comments not prompted by police questions. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Environmentalists are asking the Bush administration to help phase out a commonly used chemical that's damaging the Earth's ozone layer. The Natural Resources Defense Council also urged consumers to stop buying more than 140 products, ranging from artists' varnishes to insecticides, that contain the chemical methyl chloroform. The group compared the campaign against the chemical to that which alerted consumers about ozone-depleting chlorofluorocarbons in the 1970s. Nelson Mandela arrived in Toronto today. It's his second stop on a 3-day Canadian tour. On Wednesday, the African nationalist leader will travel to New York to begin a 10-day U.S. tour. Richard Reynolds reports from Toronto.
Nelson Mandela's arrival in Toronto was fit for a head of state. He was greeted at the airport by the Ontario Lieutenant Governor, an honor normally reserved for national leaders. Toronto's streets are decked with thousands of African National Congress flags, and this evening Mandela will be the guest of honor at an official state banquet. Mandela said his visit is to thank Canadians for their support. Canada has traditionally maintained a leadership role against South Africa's apartheid policy, particularly within the British Commonwealth, the organization that links together Britain's former colonies. However, while Canada has banned air links, tourism advertisements, and restricted diplomatic contacts, and imposed some 35 other sanctions, Canada's trade with South Africa has still managed to more than double in the past 3 years. A peculiar situation for a nation that is considered a leader in the fight against apartheid. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds in Toronto.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 54 points to close at 2,882.16 in light trading. This is NPR News. Soviet officials say that hundreds of heavily armed troops have put down a prison riot in central Russia. Troops reportedly stormed a high-security prison after rioters refused to release guards who'd been taken hostage. There was said to be one inmate killed and two wounded. The prison riot took place in a Ural mountain town about 900 miles east of Moscow. Another riot in the Ukraine is still in progress. Secretary of State James Baker's in Guatemala today, holding a series of meetings with the Central American presidents. His visit comes on the heels of a new accord between the presidents, which is aimed at reviving a Central American common market. Secretary Baker has brought a proposal whereby other industrialized nations could aid a newly unified Central America. Robert Myrowitz reports from Antigua, Guatemala.
Secretary of State Baker is holding a day-long series of meetings with the presidents of Guatemala, El Salvador, Panama, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Honduras. Mr. Baker has proposed that a funding mechanism be set up for Central America, similar to the G24 group of developed nations, which aided Hungary and Poland this past year. Mr. Baker's visit closely follows a new summit accord between the Central American presidents aimed at joint regional development and coordination of exports. The document contemplates steps towards a new Central American common market over the next 6 months, at which time a bloc of Western nations could conceivably begin to aid a Central American counterpart. Asked whether such aid efforts should be conditioned on progress in human rights in Central America, a senior State Department official said it will be the subject of some discussions here, but stop short of linking human rights to foreign aid. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Meyerowitz in Antigua, Guatemala.
The House passed a bill today calling on the United Nations to repeal a 15-year-old resolution that equates Zionism with racism. UN Resolution 3379, passed in 1975, grew out of Arab opposition to the Zionist movement to create a Jewish homeland. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Krakauer is a mountain climber and journalist. He begins his book with this observation. Mountain climbing is comprehended dimly, if at all, by most of the non-climbing world. It's a favorite subject for bad movies and spurious metaphors. A dream about scaling some high, jagged alp is something a shrink can really sink his teeth into. The activity is wrapped in tales of audacity and disaster that make other sports out to be trivial games by comparison. It's the aim of this book to prune some of this overgrown mystique. John Krakauer has climbed some of the most challenging mountains around the world. He's written about his own climbs and about several of the world's top climbers. His book, Eiger Dreams, is a collection of his articles from Outside and Smithsonian magazines. I spoke with him in April when his book first came out. In the book, Krakauer tells of times during his climbs when he asked himself, should I turn back? I asked him if there's often a moment when he asks that.
Yeah, there almost always is. And that point is actually, I mean, almost always when you start a climb, there's incredible doubts and you're scared. You usually haven't slept well the night before. You're nervous, you're worried, is the weather going to turn? Is there an avalanche going to come down? But at some point in most climbs, at least long alpine climbs, you reach a point where you have to decide either we're going to keep going and go for the top or retreat. And once you sort of pass that point, say we're going to commit, we're going to go for it, we're going to ignore the storm coming in, it's this incredible relief. You sort of don't have to worry about it anymore. You get zoned in on the climb. You don't really notice the passage of time. It's just sort of, it's this transcendental moment that it's wonderful. That's what you sort of climb for. You can't you can't predict when that will happen. And when you do retreat, I really regret some of the climbs I didn't do. I wonder if I was just being chicken when I turned around, or if I should have kept going. I mean, it stays with you for decades. So,
let me ask you about one of the climbs that you didn't complete, and that was climbing the Eiger. Can you describe the Eiger and what makes it such a challenging mountain?
Basically, it's caught the public imagination because it's just so damn dangerous. It's not a particularly attractive mountain. It's sort of this pyramid with a one face has been scooped away, so you have this vertical concave face that's dark, faces north, it's always covered with ice. The rock is not very good, so if you stand at the base of it, you hear a constant shower of rock and ice. Sort of a sinister, ugly, scary peak. Killed a lot of people before it was first climbed. And somehow its mystique owes to that dangerous image. And I don't know, every climber I've ever known someday dreams or has nightmares about climbing the Eiger. It's just one of those things. It has to do, it's sort of perverse, but then climbing itself is perverse. I don't know, I'd always thought about climbing the Eiger since I was very young. And when I had the chance to do it I actually was paid to do it for a magazine assignment, I leapt at the chance. And that is, having failed on that climb, I still second guess. And I still think about going back someday, although it makes my palms sweat to even consider that.
Well, what prevented you from finishing the climb?
I was there in October. It had been the wettest fall in the Swiss Alps in over 100 years. So we waited for 3 weeks for the weather to get good, but it kept storming. The face was plastered with snow and ice. You couldn't see the handholds underneath. You couldn't get anchors. So we got about halfway up, and we were going slow. The climbing was much more difficult than usual. And it became clear that, when I did that climb, I think I was 30. And at that point, I'd gained a little common sense, and I realized that this is really pushing our luck. I mean, it's not worth... When I was younger, I thought certain climbs might be worth dying for. By the time I was 30, I no longer thought that. And I thought that at this point on the Eiger, with ice coming down, and you know, basically there was no anchors. If one of us slipped, we roped together, we both would have fallen 3,000 feet, and you're reminded of this constantly. And I decided that I'd had enough. It was time to go down. My younger partner really just was disappointed in me for suggesting that we go down. He didn't understand what I was upset about. He thought that there's still a pretty good chance we might live and might, in fact, get to the top, and it was worth it for him. So we had a disagreement there on the face with falling ice falling around us, but our friendship has been patched up since then.
Well, how do you decide who wins when somebody wants to continue the climb and the other person wants to go back?
It can be difficult. Basically, whoever argues the loudest. The guy who wants to go down has the advantage because he can just refuse to keep going.
Good point, yeah.
He can untie from the rope and start down. But generally it's understood that you listen to the sort of the person who wants to go down. It's just sort of when you begin the climb, it's understood that everyone has the right to veto the climb, in effect. Although sometimes, nowadays, in the Himalaya especially, there's sort of a different frame of mind where it's every man for himself. They enter into it knowing that if one person gets in trouble, the other person might keep going or leave that person. It's as the stakes get higher, the game gets stranger, I guess.
John Krakauer is my guest. He's a mountain climber and journalist, and his new book, Eiger Dreams, is a collection of articles that he's written about mountain climbing, his own climbs and climbs of others. For those of us who've never done a climb like this, can you describe what kind of gear you have, how you're attached to each other as you're scaling this mountain?
On something like the Eiger? Well, yeah. In that time of year, in late October, the days are short. The climbing was difficult, so we estimated it would take 2 or 3 days to get up the climb. So on your back, you're carrying a knapsack with a light sleeping bag, a stove to melt snow for water, maybe 40 pounds of clothing and gear. In each hand, you have an ice axe, which is sort of everyone knows what an ice axe looks like, sort of like a pick with a droop pick. It's maybe 2 feet long. On your feet, you have a grid of metal spikes called crampons, two of which point forward from the toe of the boot, and you kick those into the ice, maybe half an inch. Often you're climbing on an ice climb, the picks of your ice axes will be in maybe half inch, your crampons maybe a quarter inch, and that's what's sort of holding you to the world. So, but you learn to try. I mean, you learn what will. Rarely in climbing do you fall when you don't expect to. When you've climbed long enough, you know when something's going to give way and drop you into the void. So you sort of avoid those situations, or if you think you might fall, you make sure your rope is well anchored, or if you can. Sometimes you can't, which is what keeps the game interesting. Climbing is a strange sport in that it's generated an incredible body of literature, even though relatively few people climb. In this country, it's estimated maybe 150,000 people climb. In Europe, many more people climb. It's more of a mainstream sport. But the body of literature of mountaineering is rivaled probably only by baseball and fly fishing, which tells you something that this is a sort of a very interesting, complicated sport. Climbing, it's the only sport I know of that idealizes risk. By that I mean that if you want to be a great climber, it's not enough just to do hard, difficult climbs. You also have to do dangerous climbs, like someone might do a hard rock climb, and if someone else does it without the rope, that's considered better. And this is sort of, boldness is at a premium in climbing. It's sort of amazing to me that society condones the sport. I suspect that's largely because it's not very well understood. But in this country, only about 25 to 40 people die every year, which isn't... I recently read that some actuarial experts were polled who... this was, I think, a few years ago, and they listed climbing as the 29th most dangerous activity you could do, right behind operating a power lawnmower. So maybe it's not really that dangerous.
Well, so. Tell me what rescue insurance is and how you get it.
Well, that doesn't really exist in this country. It's in the Alps, where climbing really is a mainstream sport. It's probably climbing, skiing, soccer, say, in France, or what they call football, or you know, that's what, like baseball, basketball, football here. And so hundreds, thousands of people climb in the Alps. The Alps are swarming with people of all ages, from small kids to people in their 70s and 80s. with that many people, there's a lot of, maybe 300 or 400 people die every year, thousands get in trouble. There's a highly developed, sophisticated rescue system where helicopters are always standing by. If you get in trouble, you can send off a flare or radio, and they'll come pluck you from the walls if they can right away. And these are expensive. So if you're smart, before you start climbing, you in France, I think now it's about $70 a year. You plunk down your $70. And then if you get rescued, the gendarmerie does not send you the $2,000 bill for the rescue. So that's what rescue insurance is. In this country, there aren't enough climbers. Mountain rescue is handled by sheriff departments who really aren't equipped or trained to deal with it. You're pretty much on your own in this country, which is the way it should be. I think if you enter into a climb thinking, well, if I get in trouble, I'll call for a rescue, you shouldn't be doing that climb. I mean, it sort of goes against the grain of the sport. The sport is grounded in self-reliance.
Have you ever been rescued?
No, I've thought about it. on the Eiger, I purchased rescue insurance twice before I went up on the Eiger, and a couple of years ago when I did a lot of solo climbing in Chamonix, France, at the foot of Mont Blanc. And once on a climb in the Mont Blanc Massif, a long, difficult ice climb, I was getting tired, my ice axes were dull, I was over my head and in trouble, and a helicopter flew by and paused for a minute to see if I was in trouble, and all I would have had to do was raise one arm, maybe it was two arms, I forget, to signal this helicopter that I wanted a rescue, and you know, a cable would have come down, and I could have been plucked from the wall, but I thought about it for a minute, and I just didn't know what I was going to tell the guy. I was too embarrassed, so I waved him away and continued the climb. Rescue carries a stigma to me that I'd be embarrassed to have to be rescued, although if I was in big trouble, I wouldn't hesitate to call to save my neck. I'm not that principled.
Yeah. Well, this leads to something I was thinking about before when we were talking about the decision that you always face on a climb, about whether or not you want to turn back. Well, say you decide you've had it, you're exhausted, you can't possibly make the climb, it's too dangerous and you're going to turn back. Well, it's not like you're on the ground already. First, you have to get there, so you're still exposing yourself to all these dangers. Are there any simple ways out if you want to bail out?
Well, if you're in the Alps, you can fire off your flare and the gendarmerie will come and rescue it. Most of the time, there isn't an easy way out, which is why it's so tense. Because during the day when you've got cold feet, you're wondering whether you really want to be doing this, every foot higher you climb is another foot you're going to have to go down. So it's not, this is in the back of your mind all the time. You're beneath a very difficult section. You wonder, God, if I climb that, and I turn back, I'm going to have to come down it. And there are climbs when it becomes retreat becomes impossible, at least on the route you're on, where you do have to go over the top. Very overhanging walls where it's very difficult to descend an overhanging wall because you basically drop a rope, slide down the rope, reattach it, slide down it again. And if the wall's overhanging, the rope's hanging in space and you can't necessarily swing into the wall. So, yeah, it's an interesting... What is it? Royal Robbins, a very famous climber, once said... climbing is a great sport, not in spite of the demands that it puts on us, but precisely because of them. And that's something that sort of made a lot of sense to me. So,
let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about mountain climbing. And my guest is John Krakauer, who's a climber and a journalist, and he's written a lot of pieces about mountain climbing, and several of them are collected in his new book, Eiger Dreams, Ventures Among Men and Mountains. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're talking about mountain climbing, and my guest is climber and journalist John Krakauer. Have changes in equipment made new climbs possible?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, equipment is so much better just in the last 10 years. I mean, I've been climbing, I'll be 36 in a week, and I've been climbing since I was 8. And in those 28 years, the equipment has improved so much. So people are doing harder and harder climbs, but they're not really doing anything more challenging. I mean, you look back at the guys at Ed Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, who climbed Everest with the gear they use, that's much more impressive than the people who climb Everest today. you know, in the 20s, these British gentlemen were attempting Everest from the north, wearing, you know, tweed jackets and putties, and God forbid, it's incredible. I mean, it sends shivers down my back. So yeah, climbing is, a lot of climbers sort of rant and rave about how the sport's getting too easy, gear is making it too easy, and that's probably true, but I don't see anyone, or very few people, willfully or intentionally eschew modern gear for old gear. A lot of people will limit the gear they use. I mean, solo climbing without a rope is popular in certain circles because of it's a way of keeping the climbing by fair means, was the term Ronald Messner coined, where you climb the highest peaks in the world without oxygen, or you do hard rock climbs without a rope. So, I mean, that keeps you honest, definitely.
I think one of the recent types of climbs is climbing frozen waterfalls. This is something you've done a bit of. Can you describe that?
Yeah, it's the sport was only made possible in the early 70s when Yvon Chouinard, a very famous climber, brilliant designer, invented an ice axe that allowed you to climb vertical ice. He put a little curve in the pick so it wouldn't pop out when you're hanging on vertical ice. So basically, you have a water. You know, everyone knows what a waterfall looks like in the summer. And in winter, in cold places, these waterfalls freeze into these surreal structures, these amazing, bizarre, otherworldly pillars of ice. Many of which, you know, can be 1,000 feet high. More often, they're only 400 or 500 feet high. But it's a really so it's sort of one of the latest facets of the game. And you start at the bottom. You swing your ice axes until they stick. Kick your crampons in, and you just go up. You know, every time you swing your ice axe, you move up another 20 inches, say. You have to be alert. Icicles, as you might imagine, are fragile, so you sort of have to pay attention to where you're swinging your ice axe. It's pretty neat. It's definitely, you get jazz climbing frozen waterfalls. It's you know, it can be miserable. It's cold generally. Sometimes they're dripping water, and then the water freezes on you. I mean, climbing, you know, can be looked at as a pretty masochistic activity, although that sort of simplifies it. It's not. I mean, I mean, after a hard climb, you know, you have this glow that just lasts for days, where you just kind of walk around in this fog, this euphoria, and that's sort of why you do it. Also, you do it because, like on a very hard climb, you're so intensely focused and concentrating so hard, you don't notice the passage of time. And I've done climbs that have lasted for 36 hours straight, and you know, you're amazed when you look at your watch and find out that you think, well, 5 or 6 hours has gone by, and really 24 or 30 has gone by. You're so tuned in, you're just in another state. It's like a clear-eyed dream. It's wonderful. That's sort of why people climb, I think.
John Krakauer is my guest, and he's a mountain climber and journalist, and his new book, Eiger Dreams, is a collection of his pieces about mountain climbing. Let me ask you about your climb up the Devil's Thumb, which is, we're in Alaska.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But just describe it for us.
The Devil's Thumb is, it looks like a thumb. It's very, its proportions are quite striking. It rises very near the ocean in southeast Alaska, right on the border between the Alaskan Panhandle and British Columbia. One face of it, the north face, rises 6,000 feet from the glacier at its base. The other, the south face, rises 2,000 or 3,000. It's a big peak. It's difficult. It was first climbed in 1946 by a guy named Fred Becky. It was considered one of the hardest climb ever done in Alaska. It was one of the landmarks of American mountaineering. So, it has a history. The weather there is very bad. It's close enough to the ocean that storms constantly roll through, so it's plastered with rime ice and bizarre frost feathers. And
you had to wait out quite a long storm when you were preparing
to
climb the Devil's Thumb. Is that one of the worst parts of climbing, when you're camping out waiting for a storm to end, and especially on a climb like this when you were alone?
Oh yeah, see, that's, you know, when you're at the day before, the night before, the days before, when your tent pound are the worst, because then all the fears are sort of multiplying in your mind, and you're worried that you might get killed or get hurt, or you're worried about what might happen. So, I mean, I have an active imagination, which is not an attribute for a climber. So, yeah, those are tough moments. There's nothing, you're impotent. You just lie there. There's nothing you can do. You can't even go out and walk around. The storm's howling at your tent. You can't even, there's not even room to sit up. You've read everything, every additive to the, you've read the food boxes. everything to read has been consumed. So there's nothing to do but lie there and get scared. It's always such a relief when you finally, start climbing. And it's, my God, we don't have to worry about it anymore. We're doing it. It's, whatever happens is going to happen.
Well, this was one of the first big climbs that you did. This was back in, I think, 1974, and you were working as a house builder at the time, and you'd hoped that by scaling this mountain that you would somehow change your life, that you wouldn't have to go back to the job that you didn't want anymore. And you read in your book that when you finished it, well, it didn't really change your life. You ended up having to go back to the job. And you say that this taught you a lot about what mountain climbing could and couldn't do. So tell me more about what you learned.
Again, this, when you're young, somehow you, I mean, I was obsessed with climbing. It's all I like to do. And somehow I thought if I just did the, my problems stemmed, whatever they were, if I just did the perfect climb, everything would somehow turn out right. It's hard to, I mean, that seems so silly now, but I was convinced of that. If I just, this, you know, I do a hard climb and everything would be the same, but I just, if I just did a little better climb, somehow I'd be satisfied enough or I don't know what. And if since I've learned that's absurd, that, life is what you put into it. It's just climbing. Climbing is not life. Climbing sort of, I still do it. I mean, but climbing doesn't generally lead to maturity, or many climbers seem to have a certain arrested development. many of my best friends are climbers.
So what are you looking for from climbing now?
Well, I don't use it to satisfy my ambitions. I do it sort of for recreation, the way that other people play tennis or golf or something. It just gets me out into the mountains, which I find incredibly fulfilling. I mean, even if I'm not climbing anything, just to be out in the mountains is, God, it really feels good. Come back from a good trip to the mountains and you're ready to deal with all the hassles that come with any job, but particularly writing, which, I've been writing for a living now for almost 7 years, and it's an intense way to make a living. It's sort of, as I've become more involved in writing, I've become less involved in climbing. It sort of replaced it. It's the same sort of intensity and craziness, but when things go wrong, you you don't die. You just have to figure out another way to pay the bills. So it's smarter thing to do, I think, as I get older.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Krakauer, his book is called Eiger Dreams. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, rock critic Greil Marcus, a new edition of his 1975 book Mystery Train has just come out. It's a reflection on where rock and roll fits into the larger American culture. I hope you can join us.
Well, that long black train got my baby and gone. Train, train, coming round the bend.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Back in 1962, Charles Mingus gave a performance of an unfinished composition called Epitaph. Last year, composer and musicologist Gunther Schuller conducted his adaptation of Epitaph. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the recording of that performance, which we're listening to now. Dwayne Hansen's sculptures of men and women are perfect in every detail, from the pores of the skin to the real clothes in which he dresses his statues. Coming up, Dwayne Hansen on realism that does more than fool people. And a man who's been called a national treasure died over the weekend. We have a remembrance of woodworker and furniture designer George Nakashima. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Romania, officials have arrested a key student leader who was severely injured last week by club-wielding coal miners summoned by President-elect Iliescu to enforce order in the capital. The newly elected parliament voted today to allow security forces to put an end to the latest anti-government protest in central Bucharest. Kathleen Hunt reports.
Hundreds of angry protesters are blocking traffic again into the busy center of Bucharest. They're demanding the release of the 27-year-old student leader Marian Lunceanu. He'd been a key figure in last month's nightly demonstrations, which tried to get rid of all the former communists in the present regime who are linked to Ceausescu's rule. Last Thursday, mobs of miners burst into the university, ransacked it room by room, and beat Lunceanu and several colleagues who were hiding in the basement. Today, Marian Lunceanu was dragged from his hospital bed and arrested for inciting and participating in violence. Meanwhile, the newly elected parliament today authorized security forces to clear the square once again. And today, the U.S. ambassador, Alan Green, conveyed Washington's concern about the miners' violence inspired by Iliescu last week, saying it was clear that the democratic process in Romania had come to a stop. For National Public Radio, this is Kathleen Hunt in Bucharest.
Security troops in the Soviet Union have stormed a prison where inmates were holding hostages, killing one prisoner and wounding two others. It was the second riot to cause chaos in a Soviet prison in less than a week. Bridget Kennell, the BBC, reports from Moscow.
Sunday's mutiny in the prison in Chelyabinsk apparently began when several inmates snatched keys from a warder in the prison yard, unlocked the cells of some 1,000 prisoners, and took 6 guards hostage. According to the Soviet news agency TASS, the organizers were hardened criminals, armed with knives and sticks, and this was why the authorities decided to storm the jail. Police and troops killed one prisoner and wounded 2 more before order was restored, to a rebellion that seems to have been at least partly inspired by calls to improve living conditions. This riot in the Soviet Urals came only 3 days after a similar outburst at another Soviet prison, this time in the Ukrainian city of Dnipropetrovsk. About 1,000 prisoners there went on the rampage last Thursday, setting fire to buildings after one woman claimed she'd been beaten.
Bridget Kendall of the BBC in Moscow. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that federal officials can order corporations that seek protection under bankruptcy laws to restore abandoned pension plans. The ruling involves LTV Corporation and comes in a controversy with the federal government's Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 54 points to close at 2,882.18, volume 133 million shares.
This is Fresh Air. In 1962, the late jazz bassist and composer Charles Mingus held an open recording session at New York's Town Hall. It was one of the jazz world's most notorious and colorful disasters. His orchestra had barely rehearsed, and the scores were barely ready. Copyists sat on stage, writing out parts for the musicians as they performed. When the show ran overtime, stagehands lowered the curtain as the band was playing. The major piece Mingus had been trying to finish was called Epitaph. Last year, a 2-hour version was recorded at New York's Lincoln Center. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Composer, conductor, and musicologist Gunther Schuller is the main reason Charles Mingus's Epitaph has been revived. He assembled the 18 sections, which Mingus had indicated were part of the big picture. Then Schuller arranged them in some logical order, tried to make sense of some maddening fragments and contradictions, had to figure out an ending, and corrected a couple of apparent errors I'm not sure Mingus wanted corrected. Working on one especially incoherent section, Schuller cut the score up into little scraps of paper and then scotch-taped them back together in an order he could live with. Epitaph keeps raising the same question. Is there a right way to tidy up someone else's mess and stay true to their intention? Mingus was a man of enormous creative ambitions. He was just the type to set himself a task he knew was impossible. I'm not sure he really wanted to finish Epitaph. He worked on it, off and on, for 30 years and still left it full of loose ends. I suspect he knew his musical interests were too broad to be encompassed by one work. Epitaph suggests the old cliche about a dying person watching his whole life pass before his eyes, or his ears. Its diversity is staggering. It's got mambo music. That leads directly into a rich Ellington-style orchestration. Epitaph also has some hard-rolling, sanctified church gospel music. If all these excerpts make you a little dizzy, then I'm giving you the flavor of the full set. Part of the reason Epitaph seems fragmented is that many of its sections are familiar items from the Mingus repertoire, like that last number, Better Get It in Your Soul. If you're used to hearing these pieces on their own, it's hard to think of them as part of some larger plan. Few of Epitaph's problems have to do with the distinguished musicians that make up the 30-piece band. Five of them had played the original version of Epitaph with Mingus in 1962. The orchestra almost recreates the volcanic energy Mingus inspired from his own bands, as he egged them on verbally and with his pushy bass playing. On one piece, trumpeter Wynton Marsalis shows off his newfound skills with the plunger mute. The guitarist is John Abercrombie. Epitaph also gives you a chance to hear a rare jazz bassoon solo by Michael Rabinowitz. It's on Mingus's arrangement of Jelly Roll Morton's Wolverine Blues. Despite Gunther Schuller's best efforts, what he wound up with is pretty much what he inherited from Mingus, a bunch of intriguing fragments that don't quite hang together. But that does make Epitaph true to Mingus's expansive personality. Its messiness is incurable. It's tidy proof. There's one other thing I want to mention, which is the deceptive way this set has been packaged by Columbia Records. It gives you the strong impression this is a recording by Mingus himself. Epitaph isn't perfect, but it's certainly strong enough to sell on its own merits.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Fresh Air. I once went up to a Dwayne Hansen sculpture and asked it a question. It was a life-size sculpture of a museum guard, which I thought was a real museum guard. I'm hardly the first person to make that mistake with a Dwayne Hansen sculpture. In fact, once a museum guard, after closing time, went up to a sculpture of a man and asked it to leave. When there was no response, the guard ended up calling the police. Hansen creates the convincing shapes of his figures through body casts of his models. But what also makes his sculptures look so real is his uncanny eye for clothing them, doing their hair, and giving them the perfect props. The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts just opened an exhibition of Hansen's sculptures. Hansen told me he's heard lots of stories about museum goers who've confused his statues with real people.
They take on a life of their own, and then, I used to get a little upset about that because I consider my work sort of serious work, and then they take it, all the funny things happen, but this is part of dealing with it.
But your work isn't really about fooling people.
No, of course not. And it's about sculpture, first of all, and then communicating my ideas about the human condition in this society.
What I especially like about your work is that each piece seems to be a character study of that person. It's not just a realistic rendering where you go like, boy, that looks real. I mean, you stare at the person and you feel you have a sense of what their character is. And the character is given to you both from the facial expression and through the way you've combed their hair and found their clothes and painted their complexion.
That's well stated. I really appreciate that. That's really what it's about. It's not exactly, well, it has something to do with portraiture, but it goes beyond that. It goes examining the character, like you say, of the individual to express that alienation or frustration or that fatigue or that sort of emptiness or just immersed in their own thoughts in some way.
I know when I went into the museum, the first thing I started to do was, the first piece I saw was the two tourists, and I went up to them real close, closer than I'd get to any person. And I'm like looking at the pores in their face and, looking like the label on their shopping bag and, well, I wonder what camera that is. And, I'm really giving them not just the once-over, but I'm like inspecting, the hairs growing out of their hands and stuff. And I think this is something you've talked about, how we all really want to stare at people, but in real life, there's a limit to how close you can get.
It's a taboo, really. And people can do that here and derive some enjoyment of really studying another person. Driving over here to the station today, I noticed a couple of sculptures that I'd like to do. There was a policeman at a construction site or whatever. He had a big, burly guy. And with the blue shirt and the cap, the uniform they have here in Philadelphia. And his arms are folded like he's really in an authoritative, he's watching out that, you better watch out. I mean, those things I are imprinted on my brain for months, years sometimes. I said, I got to get to do that.
When someone catches your attention and you want to do a sculpture of them, what's the next step?
Well,
is that the way it works, that you see somebody who you want to
do? I have an
do?
Idea in my head that I've got, a whole list of things that I think would be important to do. Mm-hmm. Like I have an idea of a baseball player now. And I'll get at the model. Model's coming down. And we take Polaroid shots in different positionings. And I pick the best one. And then the model stands in that position. We do molds of the legs and the body and the arms and the head. I have these molds that are filled with plastic material Bondo, body fillers that they use when you dent your car. The body shops fix your car with this stuff. I use that to cast the material into the out of the molds, and that's assembled. And the forms never come out right for me, so I improve them. Maybe the cheeks sunk in or the nose got pressed in. I build up the nostrils. I fix around the eyes. I fix stuff that doesn't come around. That's, you know, that's the sculpturing.
Let's take one of the people in the current show, Queenie, who is the janitor.
Yeah.
Was the woman who you actually cast a janitor herself? In other words, do you cast
sometimes
the person
what they are portrayed, but I'm usually more interested in the physical presence of that person, like acting in a play, playing a part.
So you cast somebody in the role.
But it probably derives from somebody I've seen like that.
Right.
But, I mean, you can't grab people off the street, I mean, especially when you're traveling around and get them. So I get the next best solution to that
You find
idea.
Someone who looks like them.
Yeah, right.
Do you shop for clothes when it's time to dress one of your statues?
Oh, yes, that's very important, and it's frustrating sometimes. Sometimes the models will give me clothes from their own wardrobe, you know, things that they don't want or something that I can buy from them that I know that they'll fit, you know. And also, if they don't have the right attire, I go shopping, and if it's something colorful, I go to Kmart and get the right size, and something would be too, you know, wrong color, the right size, but the wrong color. And I've shopped around for sometimes a week. I mean, sometimes go to the Goodwill or in places where they sell used clothing to get that worn effect. So that's very important to get the right clothing. It's sometimes frustrating, too.
Do you ever take a statue with you to make sure
that the clothes are going to fit? No, I don't scare people, I think.
You must have learned a lot about complexions, painting complexions.
Oh, yeah. The skin tone is to look like it's almost translucent. The coloring is just, we use a base coat and then a little bit airbrushing on top. Some of them are painted by hand, and they don't turn out quite as well. They have more of a makeup look. It's so delicate. And, you know, some complexions are more yellow, and some more pink, and black people, there's a lot of yellow, a lot of red, and a lot of kind of a Mars brown color.
There's a self-portrait in your current show. Yeah. It's a self-portrait with model, and it's a sculpture of you at what looks like a luncheonette table.
Right.
And sitting across the table from you is a woman in a blue and white checked house dress. The house dress is sleeveless, and in the back, her brassiere is sticking out through the sleeveless armhole.
She noticed that.
Yeah. She's pretty overweight.
Yes.
She's reading Arthritis magazine and eating a sundae. There's a copy of Woman's Day sitting on the table also. Tell me about the scene that this comes from.
Well, I wanted to do a self-portrait, and I didn't want to do an ordinary kind where in art history you see the artist holding a brush, obviously looking into a mirror and painting himself, or a sculptor carving out something. I wanted to be portrayed as an observer because that's what I do, basically, more than anything else, and that the work is derived from that. You know, every artist has to do self-portrait sooner or later, or wants to do it, or I'm sort of glad I did it.
You were, I think, about 42 when you started doing realist sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
Were you doing mostly abstraction before that?
No, I never really got into it. I never felt comfortable with doing abstract work. It was representational work. You could see it was a figure. It was modified to, you know, maybe design. Maybe the features weren't all there, but the part of the character was there. Part of the composition was there. It was carved out of wood or stone or modeled in clay. And I came to the conclusion that, so what? You know, I do this and can do this, but it doesn't really say anything about the human condition. These are works by themselves, each individual one. You have to have sort of a concept of a body of work that will convey, communicate some ideas, some concepts which you have in your head, I think. And that's what I got into when I got into realism and when pop art came to be accepted, and then realism seemed to be legitimate again. I got into it, and then one thing led to another. I did 67, I guess it was, a group of four dead shoulders and one dying to express my protests about the war in Vietnam. I did a race riot, about five sculptures in that, and then moved to New York in 1969. I did a group of derelicts off the Bowery. And then that evolved into more critical types with my first tourists and dressed out in rather outlandish attire, a supermarket shopping lady with her cart, now I do more illusionistic types, not so much manipulating of exaggeration and so on of the subject.
When I look at your sculptures, I feel like I recognize everybody. I've seen people who I know or who I've met who are very much like them. I wonder if you feel sometimes in art that we're still not quite at the point where a lot of just like real people, ordinary people, are represented. I mean, I wonder if you still feel that mostly in art, people are still idealized.
Oh, I think you're right. Yeah, and I think that's one of the major attractions to my work, that these are people that they've seen, that they know, that they recognize, and that they really have come to life.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Artist Dwayne Hansen. An exhibit of his sculptures is on view at the Museum of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia through September 23rd. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Reports that Libya may be building a second chemical weapons plant have been confirmed by the White House, and that the fire at the other chemical plant in that country, that story turned out to be, it said, a hoax. A jury has now been seated for the trial of Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry on drug-related charges. Another protest against the new government in Romania has been organized, blocking a street there in the capital city, Bucharest. That is despite and in defiance of the violence against demonstrators last week in Romania. And Larry Massett has a story about a fellow who's not only had more jobs than the rest of us, but he's kept some very interesting records of all those jobs.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The internationally esteemed woodworker and furniture designer George Nakashima died Friday evening. He was 85 years old. His work was known for its grace and simplicity, which reflected his reverence for wood. Nakashima also wrote the popular book The Soul of a Tree, A Woodworker's Reflection. Trained as an architect, Nakashima was introduced to carpentry while in a Japanese internment camp, working with a few hand tools and leftover wood scraps from camp buildings. Although Nakashima's work was exhibited in many museums, he didn't think of himself as an artist. He believed that trees were our most intimate connection to nature, and that by creating furniture, he gave a tree its second life. He elaborated on his philosophy in our 1985 interview.
The wood speaks to me of what it wants to be. So that very often I don't force my ego onto a piece of wood. I let the wood speak to me. And wood is a material. It's very spiritual. And I feel that there's only one solution. Actually, one object that can be made out of one piece of wood, or, you know, one piece of wood being a part of an object. But it has to be that. And if it isn't that, it can be a very frustrating thing, actually, for me and for the piece of wood.
You've talked about how furniture can give a tree a second life. But what about the whole question of cutting down trees? We've witnessed so much deforestation. We seem to be losing a lot of trees. Do you ever have misgivings about cutting down a tree to make furniture?
Oh, yes. I think essentially I wouldn't have the heart to cut down a very, very great tree. But they are cut down. And if they are cut down and they're offered to me, I feel that I can make the best use of them. Otherwise, they might go into something that's almost a desecration. There's one tree I bought in California. That's one of the real great trees. I have several of them. And these are usually cut into small pieces that make gun stocks. And that seems to be the best usage for very fine wood. So the logger that sells this to me is also very happy. He feels that the tree is realized, and the sensitivity of these men is very extraordinary.
Why does wood seem like an especially spiritual form for you to work in?
I think my relation to wood is at least partially racial. The Japanese have an affinity to trees and wood that I don't think any other race has. Actually, Japanese culture is based on timber. It's a wood architecture from the very beginning. Entirely different than, say, the Greeks, you know, which is a stone architecture, a stone civilization. But with Japanese, it's been wood, and there's always been that feeling towards wood that I don't think any other peoples have. And it developed into a very fine craft and a feeling towards wood as a form of life, form of philosophy, a form of creating an environment. That's very important.
Woodworker and furniture designer George Nakashima died Friday at the age of 85. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Saul Bellow. And we talk with rock critic Greil Marcus about the new edition of his classic book, Mystery Train. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.